All rise.
Seated, please. The court is ready to hear argument in 080465, the State of Texas versus United States currently.
Mr. Davis will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Petitioner will open with the first 5 minutes. Mr. Jordan will present 10 minutes of argument for amicus curiae, the Office of the Solicitor General.
May it please the court. As a first order, I would like to say that the state, the extent is represented by the district attorney's office in Hidalgo County, is going to waive its first issue that's before the court, and that's the issue with regard to the judgment notwithstanding the verdict being granted by the trial court level. While it's our position that we think it was error for the trial judge not to grant the directed verdict, as the case was charged, there's really nothing for the appellate court to reverse as far as, because there wasn't an issue submitted to the trial court regarding whether Mr. Huerta had any type of ownership or equitable interest in the money. So we've adopted the position of the Solicitor General, which leaves us with the case as it stands now, where the 13th Court of Appeals has overturned the trial court's JNOV, but has awarded all of the currency at a question in this case.
The Solicitor General doesn't think there was evidence of contraband. You still think there is?
Judge, I think there is. I think there's some evidence of it, but I also can understand their position that there's not enough evidence to overturn the jury's decision that it wasn't contraband. Personally, I think it wasn't.
So bottom line, you're waving the white flag on the JNOV?
Yes, sir. So what we're left with was a decision by the 13th Court of Appeals. We have a finding where the currency wasn't contraband. The two individuals who were the owners, one of them had ostensibly had to be the owner of the currency, Mr. Mercado or Mr. Polito. Neither of them appeared at trial. Mr. Mercado was served personally with the petition in the case. He elected not to proceed. A default judgment was entered against him. Mr. Polito's involvement with the case was he was the registered owner of the truck tractor within which the currency was seized.
Does the record reflect that he was served? Or just as it?
Judge, he was served by citation by publication. And in accordance with the rules of civil procedure, an attorney ad litem was appointed on his behalf.
What about Mercado?
Mercado was served personally and never appeared in the case. Mr. Huerta, who was the tow truck driver who was towing the truck tractor, he did intervene in the case. And he asserted basically two points to the trial court and to the jury at the trial court level some of the money. And he was saying either there was a bailor bailee relationship between him and the owner and the money, or alternatively that there's some type of finder's keeper's doctrine that would entitle him to some or all of the money. With regard to the finder's keeper's doctrine, of course there is no basis in Texas law for finders keepers. I think actually what he was trying to assert was sort of a treasure trove theory, saying like I found the money, so I should get some of it or all of it. And the jury actually gave him or awarded him $70,000 of the $281,000. What I think Texas courts have looked at as far as when money's found or an item's found. It's either characterized as being mislaid property or property that's lost. And in this case, I think the evidence is pretty clear that, if anything, this was mislaid property. Somebody...
Or could have been abandoned because maybe it was drug money. Nobody wanted to come forward and make a claim to it.
Correct. Well, I think as far as Mr. Mercado and Mr. Polito are concerned, they obviously abandoned at least their right to contest that it was contraband. The facts of the case, it's not a situation where Mr. Huerta came upon the money out in the field and said, oh, this must be, you know, some drug money that somebody left behind. He was actively involved in removing the money from the truck and assisting the DPS and the U.S. Customs officers in removing it.
There was a point at which he was, where the examination was basically done, and that he then on his own went into the tailpipe or whatever. I mean, I didn't understand that.
Well, I think what happened, Judge, is that the truck tractor's being towed, and the DPS trooper makes a traffic stop on the expressway near San Juan, Texas, and they do an inspection there on the side of the road.
Talking about it at the customs.
Right, at the customs. I think Mr. Huerta's testimony was that the customs agents and the DPS agents were working more towards the front of the truck. He was at the back, and he's the one that first found that there was something in that well housing. I mean, that's not contested. I mean, the facts are the facts. He had the tools to remove that, and he did it, and he was probably the first one to even touch one of those packets.
Okay, your time has expired. I don't know if you want to let the state argue, or you can continue. It's up to you.
No, sir, I'll.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Jordan, take over.
Good morning. May it please the court. This case presents the question of how seized property that has been made subject to a Chapter 59 civil forfeiture proceeding should be disposed of after it's been determined not to be contraband, but the owner of the property remains unknown. The court should now make clear that under these circumstances, the property should be disposed of under Article 1817 of the Code of Criminal Procedure.
How often does this happen?
Your Honor, it does not appear to happen particularly often. We found just a few cases, some unreported cases, where property was disposed of under Article 1817. But certainly the lower court's opinion indicates some confusion that under these circumstances, Article 1817 is relevant. It did appear that the Court of Appeals felt like it had to award the money to somebody. If it wasn't contraband going to the state, it needed to give it to whoever else was in the proceeding, and there was not even a discussion of Article 1817. So, from the state's perspective, the court has an opportunity to provide some guidance here to state entities and lower courts that in this situation.
What about the waiver argument, though, that if it wasn't ever raised, then how do we address it?
Your Honor, the waiver argument raised by Mr. Huerta misunderstands the reason that the state's brief had discussion of Article 1817. Article 1817 is not presented as a theory of recovery for the state. The state did not and could not assert that as a trump to an otherwise valid legal claim that Mr. Huerta has in the property. Indeed, this court must first determine that Mr. Huerta has no valid legal claim to the property, and therefore that part of the Court of Appeals judgment must be reversed. But then the court faces the question of what should happen with the property. And it's true, certainly, that this court could enter a judgment that said nothing about Article 1817. The court could say nothing whatsoever about it. And at that point, if it reversed the Court of Appeals judgment, of their own force, the provisions of Article 1817 would come into effect, and Hidalgo County would be required to dispose of the property under its provisions.
Can you help me out here? If it's not contraband, why does he not have a legal claim to that money?
The reason he does not, Justice Medina, is that he has not articulated, and there is no Texas statute or common law principle under which Mr. Huerta would be entitled to possession or ownership of the property. As you noted earlier, he has asserted a number of different common law claims, one of which is finders keepers. He has attempted to make a bailment claim. Those are essentially his two arguments. And if I can go through briefly why neither one of those has merit. His bailment argument has no merit in the first place because he has judicially admitted that he is not acting as a bailee here. he has presumably, Mr. Mercado, who was the bailor of the Freightliner, would have been the person who is his bailor. But he has, in his own pleadings, said Mr. Mercado has abandoned his interest and has asserted his own, meaning Mr. Huerta's ownership interest. So he's judicially admitted he's not acting as a bailee here. Moreover, that's not surprising, I guess, because there's clearly no express contract for him to be a bailee for the currency. His own testimony at trial said, I had no idea the money was there. I made no agreement to transport the currency. Plus, his invoice for towing indicates obviously nothing about the currency. And Texas law would only recognize an implied bailment contract if the currency was in plain sight or if it was reasonably anticipated to be part of what he was transporting. And certainly, it was not reasonable for him to anticipate $281,000 in duct tape bundles in the axle of the truck.
What's the state law on? Excuse me, on treasure hunters that come upon treasures, sunken ships like the LaSalle off the coast of Texas and other things like that. Do they share that with the state?
There is a case that, indeed, Mr. Werper cites the Platoro case that actually has to do with exactly what you're talking about, Justice Medina. It's a sunken Spanish galleon. And in that case, the res, or the artifacts and the galleon itself, were determined to actually be the property of Texas. But if it was, for example, a marine salvor, a marine salvage company, they might be able to try and get money back from the state for the cost of the salvage operation. In that case, it's a federal district court case, the court did cite to Texas doctrine on lost and mislaid property, and it cited to this court's seminal case, the Schley case, as its guiding principle. Under the Schley case, it's quite clear that this currency would be considered mislaid property, because mislaid property is property that was obviously intentionally placed somewhere by an owner with the intent that they would come back and retrieve it, but then someone else finds it. Certainly someone acted with intention to duct tape this material, put it into the axle. It's similar to the Schley case, where there was a jar found by a workman hidden in the ground, a jar with $1,000, and the court said, you know, that's got to be mislaid. So under any of those, let me finish. Mislaid property, to the extent it's found, is actually held as bailee by the owner of the premises. In this case, that would be presumably the owner or the person held the possession of the Freightliner, which is the one item of property Mr. Huerta has undisputedly said he has no interest in whatsoever. So clearly, under a mislaid property theory, he's not entitled to it, nor is he entitled to the property under an abandonment theory. As you noted, Justice Medina, abandonment under Texas law requires that someone has relinquished title to the property or ownership without the intent to vest it in anyone else. That remains unowned until someone acquires it with the intent to acquire title. Clearly, the record here in this evidence establishes a matter of law that Mr. Huerta never tried to establish title at the time that it was found. In fact, if you look in the reporter's record, volume 5, pages 39 and 40, he says he's looking in that area of the truck at the command of the DPS officers. He immediately gives it to them when it's found. In the succeeding days, he never makes any claim to the money. Indeed, he calls Mr. Mercado or Mr. Pulido and tells them that the money's been found. So there's no claim under abandonment. There is another case that Mr. Huerta relies upon that I assume his counsel will talk about and I'd like to address. And they refer to it as the Bazan case. It's actually State versus $2 million cited in their brief. And they say that, well, you know, that case is controlling here, because in that case, like here, there was a forfeiture suit, and then the forfeiture suit didn't work, and they gave the money to the lady they took it from. Her name was Rosa Bazan. The key difference between this case and that case is that in the Bazan case, the state judicially admitted, this is at pages 726 and 727 of that opinion, the state judicially admitted that Ms. Bazan was the owner of the property. That's diametrically opposed to this case, where throughout this litigation, Hidalgo County has said Mr. Huerta has no interest in possessing or owning this property. So the Bazan case simply doesn't advance the ball at all for Mr. Huerta. And the other, the waiver argument, as I've stated, we would like, and we are hoping the court will include in its opinion, some language indicating that Article 1817 does control in these circumstances. The court need not do so, But the lower court's opinion does indicate that there may be confusion on this issue.
Under Article 1817, A says that this unclaimed or abandoned property is delivered to the municipality or the purchasing agent of the county for disposition. And then the subsections B, C, and D provide for a notice in the paper. And if the property is still not claimed within 90 days, then the municipality or county may sell it. So there's still an opportunity for the owner to come forward under Article 1817.
Indeed there is, Justice Wainwright. And in fact,
if he or she dare appear, I suppose.
That's correct, Justice Wainwright. And indeed, the statute provides that if someone did appear, they and the county either denied the claim or failed to act on the claim within 90 days, that person could file a lawsuit in the local district court. This is under provision 1817E. So they could file a lawsuit in a court of competent jurisdiction. I do agree with you that I think that's unlikely in this case that someone would appear. But the statute provides and allows for someone to do so and to make a claim and indeed to appeal a denial of that claim through the court system.
So let me ask you this. Let's say I'm walking down the street and I find a wallet and it's got a lot of money in it but no ID in it. And I can either keep it and don't tell anybody about it, or I can go to the police and say, I think somebody's lost their wallet. And then a notice goes out. Does anybody claim it? And under your interpretation of the law, if nobody claims it, that wallet goes to the police. I mean, it goes to the municipality. It's abandoned.
Yes, I think your hypothetical, Justice Nail, was there was no ID in it, so there's no way of knowing whose money that was.
Right.
And correct, if you turned it in that way and it's an amount that's less than $500, or even if it was more than $500, that would ultimately
be
the result.
What's the incentive for her to turn it in?
Right.
Well, let me say this. Under the common law, a wallet that was just fall on the ground on the sidewalk, that would be considered lost property. I'll just finish my answer. That would be considered lost property, lost through inadvertence, neglect, carelessness. You could, in that circumstance, actually hold that wallet, and your claim to holding it would be good as against anyone but the true owner. The true owner could come and make a claim that wallet. We know that from the Neal versus Kirkland case, which is cited in our brief at page 19. But if you turned it in, yes, it would. The Hidalgo County would be required to follow those procedures once you turned it in.
Chief, may I ask one more question?
Yes, Justice.
I think I know what the answer is, but so you left counsel's table and you left your wallet here. That's an abandoned property, right? But you never came back to get it, and it has no ID. We assume it's yours. So that would be abandoned.
I'd like to think under that circumstance, Justice Medina, it wouldn't be considered abandoned because I wouldn't have had the intent to relinquish.
Misplaced?
Huh?
Misplaced?
What's
the difference? I mean, how do we analyze that differently?
Let's test the theory. We'll see what happens.
You'll never
know. Fortunately, I did not bring my wallet with me. But I do think that the cases that talk about abandoned property, and this goes to what you noted earlier, that this may be a circumstance where somebody was intentionally abandoning the property. Indeed, Mr. Mercado, the evidence showed Mr. Mercado was well aware that the vehicle was being stopped and he was circling and he knew it happened and he drove off and never attempted to make any claim to it. I think he would want to look for some sort of conduct or demonstrable omission on the part of the owner before you could say this is really abandoned.
Thank you.
There are no further questions.
Yes. What's the difference between lost and mislaid?
The difference between lost and mislaid is this, Justice O'Neill. Mislaid property is property that the owner intentionally placed somewhere. For example, in the Chalet case, the jar that was buried in the ground, that wasn't inadvertent, that wasn't accidental. Somebody dug a hole, they put the money in the jar, and they buried it. Lost property is property that's lost through neglect or inadvertence. For example, I leave my watch at a restaurant or I leave my watch somewhere, accidentally. So that's the difference between lost and...
And let me make sure I understand your position. If it is your watch that you left at a restaurant and I find it, and it's lost and nobody claims it, who gets it?
If it's lost and someone secures possession with the intent to acquire title, to acquire ownership, someone would need to be holding that with the intent to acquire ownership. That person would hold it as against the true owner. In other words, that person could hold that property unless and until the true owner came forward, and they could not hold the property. So if it's my watch and you're holding it and I find out and I file a suit, you're not going to be able to keep that watch against me if I can show them the true owner.
But if I turn it into the restaurant and say, if they don't come back after a certain period of time, let me know, because then it's mine, do I have a valid claim?
If you turn it over to the restaurant?
Where it's left, and say, if anybody calls, here it is, but if nobody calls, it's mine.
That's an interesting question, Justice O'Neill, because the question might be whether or not, if you turn it over immediately to the restaurant, might be whether or not you were attempting to hold the property or not for yourself, or if you were turning it over to someone else.
Any further questions?
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
The court, Mr. Millett will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, Gregorio Huerta, as responded here, asked the court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals correctly cited respondent's pleadings, wherein he stated his claim that his interest in the currency is superior to the state's. I'll begin by discussing his interest in the currency, and then turn to Code of Criminal Procedure, Article 1817, cited by petitioner. In discussion with the court on intervention, reported in Volume 6, 7, page 6, we agreed that a party to a lawsuit is anyone with an interest. The owner of property is defined by statute, Code of Criminal Procedure 5901-6, an owner is anyone with an equitable or legal ownership interest. Equitable or legal ownership interest. The statute provides at 5903-D that the last party in possession can make a claim for the property at the time of seizure. I'll digress to say Mr. Huerta is barely literate and not learned in the law, but his legal right to claim recovery attached at time of seizure.
Okay, when was the cash seized?
It was seized when the truck went under the control of DPS Trooper Torres.
But isn't that a point we have to decide? Because the argument's made that was just the truck being seized, and the cash wasn't seized until the truck was under the possession of the department.
With respect, in our law, we contemplate two times of possession, actual and constructive. When law enforcement took constructive control and possession of the vehicle, they had possession and seizure of the contents, whether they knew the contents or not. Then actual physical holding of the cash occurred after Huerta cut the packages open with his pocket knife, whereupon the officers on the Bridget Hidalgo took it.
And what if that would have been dope?
Sir?
What if that package would have been dope? Would that dope have been his? I'm sure he wouldn't be making a claim for that, right?
You asked two questions. The answer to the second question would be no, because that's per se contraband. But the answer to the first question might be well be yes, because under criminal law, for criminal responsibility, there must be both possession and knowledge or intent. So that if he did not know or intend that it was contraband until it was in the presence of, and he was under the instructive of, and acting under the orders of law enforcement, then his possession would not be culpable.
Well, how's that any different here? He's not a learned man, but he's obviously wise enough to hire counsel. He opens this and it turns out to be money. So how's that any different, his knowledge and culpability?
What is different here is that the money is not contraband. It's not per se contraband, By the decision of the jury, it is not in fact contraband, and by the abandonment of the state of their contention, it is, as the law of the case, not contraband. And so that would be the distinction between currency and narcotics, respectfully.
Okay, I'm just curious, what could it be if it's not contraband, even though we're not to decide that issue? What could that money be? Just a gift from a leprechaun? Or?
It is a digression, but I will talk about it. We complained that the court instructed the jury only in the most general and vague terms, because we won this argument, I left the definition over here. They said contraband means the proceeds gained from the commission of a felony under Chapter 481 Health and Safety Code, Texas Controlled Substances Act, a felony under Chapter 483 Health and Safety Code. We objected to that as giving the lay people on the jury no guidance. Who knows what's in Chapters 481 and 483 of these statutes? There was no amplification of the instruction and no testimony about it. The solicitor conceded in his brief that it might have been some other violation of the law, not in those specific chapters, or perhaps no violation of the law at all.
What's his equitable claim to the money?
His equitable claim to the money gives, that's an excellent question, because it gives me a right to continue. When we started our dialogue, I had pointed out that the last party in possession has a right to claim it at time of seizure. The statute further provides under 5904D that the last party in possession at time of seizure shall be a party to a lawsuit. Now that is mandatory language, shall be a party. I had the opportunity, and this commingles with our 1517 discussion that we'll have in just a few minutes, to go back and read the statute carefully to determine how these statutes could be different and how the legislature could have written them both. Under 5904L, requiring that the last party in possession at time of seizure shall be a party, is 5904K, the successive statute, attached as an exhibit as an attachment in the materials and in the statutes. If no person was in possession of the property at the time it was seized, and if the owner of the property is unknown, no person in possession, and the owner unknown, the attorney representing the state shall file with the clerk of the court in which the proceedings are pending an affidavit, etc., leading to citation by publication. So that in a proceeding for forfeiture under Chapter 59, notice goes to a person who says, I am an owner, and the last party in possession. The property rights of the public are protected to the extent that the last party in possession has a right to be made a party to the lawsuit. Gregorio Huerta testified.
Is it your position then that the right to be made a party to the lawsuit gives him an interest in the property?
Yes, particularly in the factual context of this case, where he acquired control of the truck lawfully by contract, and where under his undisputed testimony, when a person who employs him to convey cargo does not subsequent claim recovery from him, he acquires ownership. He used the specific example in his testimony that in the year preceding the seizure, he had acquired title to some 13 trucks and their contents. It is a part of his business to acquire ownership of property and cargo lawfully in his possession for hire.
I'm just trying to understand, apart from those facts, you said yes with these particular circumstances in the case, but I'm just trying to understand, does J by itself, 59.04J by itself, give the person who is made a party an interest in the property?
Yes, sir. It gives him an
interest.
Even if
he was just wandering by at the time and happened to find it?
No. It has to not be contraband. Second, he has to be found, in fact, to be in possession. That is, as defined in the court's charge, in compliance with the Code of Criminal Procedure.
So even if, under the law, apart from the statute, he would not have an interest in the property. The statute gives him an interest.
The statute gives him an interest because he's the last party in the possession. It is not contraband. He shall be made a party. And indeed, notice need not be given to all the world if he is known to be the party in the possession. And finally, he has an equitable interest established under his testimony to acquire title to that which his customer or any other person makes no subsequent claim.
Mr. Mallett, what does it mean for a seizure to take place? Is there some official act that's done, papers signed, or is it just when, as in this case, the authorities retain possession?
I believe the law would sustain this proposition that a seizure occurs when the state of Texas, acting through law enforcement authorities, takes effective control of the property and the individual is no longer able to do with it as he wishes, destroy it, remove it, travel away with it. Certainly happened here when those packages turned out to be currency.
But he never at that point or any time later said, no, this is mine. I own this property, or that I'm the owner, and
well,
you shouldn't.
I said that in the intervention. What he said was that Agent Torres told him when he went around the next day, oh, we're going to give you something. We're going to give you a reward. And then rolling back, at volume 5, why did you leave it there at the DPS? Answer, they instructed me to leave it there. And then turning over to page 17, same volume, they told me no one claimed it. They told me they'd give me a reward. And then there's a little talk about how they gave him a runaround from agency to agency.
Well, that happens sometimes in the government. But why wouldn't he be entitled to the entire amount?
Because, as the Court of Appeals correctly found, he has an interest in the property superior to any interest of the state of Texas.
Maybe the state has an interest in fighting crime. It's hard to imagine, and I understand the J&OV point is gone, but it's hard to imagine how this money came to be where it was without some form of criminal activity taking place. And as between the state and its citizens and a person who happens upon this mislaid or lost property, it seems to me equitably be better to remain in the hands of the state.
What I know is we're here under the laws of the state and not sitting in terms of trying to decide what's fair and square. And as amicus expressing the views of the state of Texas conceded, it may have been from some offense outside the narrow definition.
Maybe under the laws, maybe under the laws of the state, it makes more sense to channel this through an 18.17 proceeding rather than let it remain in the hands of just somebody who happens upon what appears to be either a drug-related or other crime-related mislaying or secreting of money.
Well, then perhaps I should move forward from this express statutory language that he shall be made a party and that the only notice need to go to a known owner and the last party in possession, and turn to Article 1517.
1817, please. Would your client have the right to assert an ownership interest after a publication in an 1817 proceeding?
Yes, sir, Your Honor. I was going to wind up there, but we'll just start there. Under the 1817 proceeding, which the Solicitor General suggests we might want to consider doing now, beginning 7 years later, there are two relevant concepts. One is that in that proceeding, there shall be notice published to all the world if the owner is not known. Now, we claim he's the equitable owner, and he would come in and say, I'm the owner, give me the money. And then the statute says, well, if they don't happen to agree with you, they, by the way, are no longer the district attorney in the Department of Public Safety who want to divide this money 50-50. They now, under 1817, become the purchasing agent for Hidalgo County or the sheriff of Hidalgo County if Hidalgo County has no purchasing agent. And they then publish notice if the owner is not known and someone can step up. Gregory Huerta can step up now
next year, the year after, and say it's mine. And if they decline to give it to him, it becomes his burden to initiate an entirely new lawsuit. And upon that lawsuit, what other person might be in court based on the citation by publication to controvert his claim? Well, we really don't know. But we do know this. Under this statute, subsection G, there is a provision that if after proceedings occur, either a contest by the claimant or the absence of a contest, so that under the statute, the materials are now in the possession of the sheriff or now in the possession of the purchasing agent if Hidalgo County has one, they may order that the property, after disposition, the seizing agency can request transfer of the property for use by the seizing agency. Here, well, that might be the Department of Public Safety and its partner in the division of proceeds, the district attorney for Hidalgo County. So we can come around full circle and wind up the same place. What is different? What is different are the notification requirements. Only the last party in the possession and the owner, if known, need be given notice under Chapter 39 forfeiture. The owner, and if the owner is not known, must be given notice by publication under the other provision of the Code of Criminal Procedure, and in that case, the claimant must file a lawsuit rather than the lawsuit initiated for forfeiture by the state. But the twin issues of whether there is an equitable ownership that ripens into an ownership interest and entitles him to recovery of the property remains, and the concept that the money would be somehow returned or would be returned ultimately to the, for use by the district attorney's office who chose to plead narrowly remains the same. If they had pled broadly, then they might have pled that the money was from some non-narcotics offense, money laundering, bulk cash smuggling, tax evasion, people cobbling their money together and trying to...
Let me ask you this. Your client was not paid in advance for moving the truck from point A to point B. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I may have misled you. He was paid, but he was given a down payment. And then subsequently, the balance of the money that was paid.
So partially paid, but not fully paid?
Yes, and he called Trooper Torres first and said, I'm worried this fellow hasn't come to pay me the rest of my money. Maybe there's a problem. Maybe this truck is stolen.
If your client had been fully paid on the front end, would it make a difference?
In my judgment, it would not make a difference.
Still have an equitable or legal ownership
stake?
He
was the last party in possession before seizure by the state. He would have an interest superior to the interest of the state of Texas under these pleadings. They could have pled in the alternative, if this currency is not contraband, then we request that the court allow us to deliver it to the purchasing agent of the county or the sheriff of the county for disposition under Article 15-17 for the reason that there is no criminal case or investigation now pending. But those were not in their pleadings. Those were not in their jury instructions. That was not in their brief in the Court of Appeals.
So if we close,
that was not in the motion for rehearing in the Court of Appeals.
So if we close that, Mr. Mallett, if we close our eyes to what appears to be contraband, which is going to be hard to do, but and then we'd look at this $70,000 and you have an equitable claim, which seems to make sense, and these claims perhaps don't happen often. What do you want us to do? Obviously, let your client keep this money, and then perhaps the Department of Public Safety or Homeland Security shouldn't let private individual citizens be involved in the search of a vehicle, and maybe that will correct the problem. But this is a tough issue to resolve.
Well, I think we should encourage citizen police cooperation. People should not be afraid of their police agencies and should be feel that if they are in suspicious circumstances that might be of interest to law enforcement, that they should be encouraged to bring law enforcement in, and they should be confident that law enforcement will respect the laws that protect the rights of all the citizens, including the last party in possession before seizure. The law abhors a forfeiture. They brought this under a forfeiture statute. They choose their statutes and their grounds for relief here for a division of the money between two specific agencies and not for all the citizens of the state of Texas. It was their election, waived throughout the case and through this day, that they, until amicus filed, come at entering the case from left stage, saying, well, wait a minute, there's
the
another
court,
provision
the court invited,
of the law.
The court invited the state.
Absolutely. And the court may wish to write an opinion saying, well, on timely application and pleading in its third amended petition, there might have been grounds for relief that were then available involving other sub-agencies or subdivisions of the state of Texas or the county.
And just out of curiosity, where did the jury get $70,000?
If I can be informal.
Sure.
Some say that some juries decide cases with their hearts as much as their heads. Mr. Huerta was given the runaround on this. He found the money. He gave this away. If he was not a good citizen reporting it to Officer Torres and getting the police involved, none of this would have happened. The state would, the state looks for a windfall just as much as Mr. Torres and Humbley looks for a windfall.
So it's just an
nobody earned this money that's in this lawsuit.
$70,000 is less than the 30% he said he was... The officer agreed to give him.
I cannot answer what happened in that jury room. It would not be relevant here. The parties all agree that the answer to question number three is immaterial under the facts and law that apply to the case. One brief comment as my time is out. I have 40 seconds.
About the Freightliner.
The state of Texas elected to sever the Freightliner in the case. The state elected to pursue the Freightliner in one district court under one cause number and the currency in another district court under another cause number. As the memorandum opinion correctly states on page 9, footnote 12, Mr. Huerta made a decision that he would not seek recovery of the Freightliner because the condition it was in was such that it was simply not worth it. The issue of the Freightliner is not material to the disposition of this case.
I think there are two questions. Justice Willett, did you have one? Justice O'Neill.
When you say the state could have chosen to bring some other type of claim, what claim are you talking about they could have brought other than forfeiture for contraband?
Oh, they could have said, we're holding this currency for investigation in a criminal case. And we have determined there is not a criminal case because there's not. And so we ask that if there is a finding it is not forfeiture, we be allowed to keep it to turn over to the sheriff or the purchasing agent for disposition pursuant to the Code of Criminal Procedure.
And that would be under 1817, abandoned property or evidence?
That would be correct. They could have made that in their pleadings right, and 7 years ago.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Counselor.
I'm not aware that we could litigate the issue of 1817 initially in a lawsuit that our main pleading would be Chapter 59. My experience with 1817 is actually done non-judicially, and it's only if somebody comes forward and makes a claim to the property and the commissioner's court of the county denies their claim that actually that person making the claim has to initiate the litigation. So as far as my rebuttal to that assertion, I don't believe that would be possible for us to plead alternatively forfeiture under Chapter 59, but if we don't get that, we want abandonment under Chapter 1817.
Does 5904 give the party in possession some sort of ownership interest, equitable ownership interest?
We differ on that. I don't believe it does. It does say that the person in possession at the time of the seizure should be made a party.
Should or shall?
Shall. Shall be made a party. I think the way it's written, to be honest with you, the legislator looks at vehicle forfeitures, and this happens a lot. Somebody's driving a vehicle. It has marijuana, cocaine. It's stopped. The officer sees the vehicle. Quite often, the person that was operating the vehicle is not the registered owner, not even an equitable owner, but is a mule employed by some, you know, drug smuggling organization, but that they're supposed to be given notice. In this case, obviously, the DPS trooper is the one who prepared what's called the seizure affidavit. He makes a determination in the field as to who may be the owner, who was in possession, things like that. Feel that Mr. Huerta was ever actually in possession of the currency. Certainly Mr. Huerta was there in the field. He had contact with the currency. He initiated the police action which led to the seizure of the currency. But the testimony at trial from Mr. Huerta and from Trooper Torres was Mr. Huerta never asserted any ownership interest at the scene of the seizure. He never asserted any ownership interest.
Why does that matter, though? You're not claiming he waived raising that issue. I mean, he
Well, because Mr. Mallett is saying that Mr. Huerta should have been made a party to the forfeiture action from the beginning, which he wasn't. He actually intervened in the case. So that's why Mr. Huerta has said it made some type of difference.
But that was his basis for intervention, as being the party in possession.
Exactly. I don't think in his pleadings he never asserted any ownership interest, or he did not insert any ownership interest in the currency.
Party in possession, why, and if this is not contraband, which has been conceded, as a party in possession, why isn't the party in possession, why don't they have a superior right to the state if contraband is not proven? Why shouldn't they?
Because they would have to show some ownership interest or equitable interest in some or all of the property.
Well, but again, why, as between two people with property who you might give the property to, why wouldn't the person who possesses it have a superior interest equitably if there's no basis for a seizure, no basis for a forfeiture?
Meaning that there's a finding that was not contraband, so the next step is, who do we give it to? So sort of putting it how the 13th Court of Appeals looked at it. I think because in this particular case, because Mr. Huerta never established any interest, equitable or otherwise.
Neither did the state. And so my question, nobody having any ownership in it, we've got to decide who does it go to? And give me a reason why it should go to the state as opposed to the person who has possession.
Well, I think while we're here not saying that it should go to the state, we're here saying that what the court should do is say 1817 applies here. The property's not contraband. The owners, who the law enforcement
okay,
dealt
so,
with
okay, so let's say that happens, and then an abandonment proceeding begins, and Huerta comes in and files a equitable claim because I had possession.
Then he would have to go before the commissioner's court, as I understand it, make the claim. They would have to make a decision as to whether Mr. Huerta was entitled to the money or some of the money. If they did not make a decision that was favorable to him, he would have the opportunity to bring a lawsuit against the county to recover the money and prove his case.
It could be a little troubling that we have a man driving down a lonely stretch of road in possession of the tractor and the truck and everything there. I mean, nobody else is in possession of it. And he gets stopped, and there's no determination that anything was done illegally. There was a seizure and no determination anything done illegally. And the state now takes that property as opposed to giving it back to the person who, as far as anyone knows, had permission of whoever owned it before, whoever had it before. The state just jumps in and says, well, we're going to take this property and start proceedings. It just seems somehow that bothers you, your sense of what's proper as to property rights, citizens, as opposed to the state. So he actually was in possession of this, was he not? You say he was not in possession of the money, but wasn't he at all times until the state took it away from him? Wasn't he in possession of it?
I think, he was definitely in possession of the truck tracker that contained the money.
Who's in possession of the money when he's driving down the road out there? Was the DPS?
No, sir.
Well, who was?
think Mr. Huerta was, being, by virtue of his being in possession of the truck tractor, was also in possession of the money, even though his testimony was he didn't know the money
was in. He had a load of cantaloupes. Who would have been in possession of the load of cantaloupes as he drove down the road?
Mr. Huerta would have been. But then again, by the law, if he knows a load of cantaloupes are there, obviously he has knowledge, and his bailor-bailey relationship, if it's something that's open and obvious.
We're not talking bailor-bailey. We're talking in possession.
What does it matter? I'm sorry. What does it matter if he has knowledge or no knowledge? If he's going to transport these goods across America, what difference does it make if he has knowledge?
Well, for him to make an ownership or an equitable claim to the property, he, by his own...
Does the statute require him to have knowledge on an equity claim?
I think so. I think he would. I mean, or to make even a claim under abandonment, he would have had to have knowledge. He testified he didn't have knowledge. He knew about the money at the same time the DPS troopers and custom agents knew about it they're pulling it out of the
He knew
accident.
Where to go look for it.
He did. Yeah, and that's not contested. I mean, he's the one that had the tools and knew where it probably was.
But you also agree it's not contraband. And it's not contraband, correct?
That's the position we're taking here, Judge.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this morning, and the marshal will adjourn the court.